that's on the equal kind of playing field, if you will, which is kind of contradictory to capitalism itself. You guys, this is just scratching the surface on this, so I think we're going to have to do like a part two in a couple weeks or something. If you guys have time, let's get you back on and keep talking about this stuff, because we do got to close pretty soon. Want to make sure that our listeners are getting the resources. So, Daniel, Michael, can you share, you know, where are people going to check this stuff out? You know, what are the links, Facebook pages, etc.?
Yeah, so we have... Can I start? Yeah.
Go ahead.
So find us on Strike Debt Portland on Facebook. We're a Facebook group, Strike Debt Portland. We have an email list as well, that you can just find us under Google Groups. We are going to host teach-ins throughout the day tomorrow at Cathedral Park to coincide the Shell No kayak actions against the oil drilling. We're doing teach-ins on climate debt. Thanks.
Okay, Michael?
As a resource for your listeners, the best thing that I can suggest is that they visit strikedebt.org and check out the Debt Resistors Operations Manual, which is available either in print form, but it's also available as a free download on that website. And in that, if there's certain categories of debt that they're suffering from, they can check those out individually. Or they can look through the whole book, of course. And as I said, it's a free download. So that's a great resource for people. And if anybody is suffering from harassing phone calls from debt collectors, they should check out Strike Debt Bay Area. Google that, and that'll take you to our Tumblr site. And there's a resource there are resources for challenging or getting to the bottom of what's going on. Sometimes debt collectors are fraudulently representing themselves as the owner of your debt, they can't prove that they own your debt. And this is a tool for insisting that they prove that they own your debt, because if they can't, then they've got to shut up.
Right. Okay. Yeah. You've been listening to Prison Pipeline on KBO Portland 90.7 FM, excuse me. Next week will be hosted by Ruth Kovacs. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs on KBOO.FM/Prison Pipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Want to thank our guests Daniel Hong and Michael Wilson. Thank you guys so much. We'll get you back on soon. Special thanks to our engineer, Danielle Parks. Have a great evening. Free them all, and we'll see you next week.
KBU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the summer concert in Dawson Park, featuring a live performance by Bamba y su Pilon da Sucar Band on Wednesday, July 29th at 6:30 p.m. The mission of summer concerts in the park is to bring cultural diversity to metropolitan area residents. Bamba y su Pilon da Sucar Band play a full range of popular and traditional salsa, son cubano, timba, and tropical styles as cumbia, merengue, y bachata. Again, that's the summer concert in Dawson Park with Bamba y su Pilon da Sucar Band on Wednesday, July 29th at 6:30 p.m. Dawson Park is located at North Stanton and North Williams Avenue in Portland. More information about ticket prices and directions can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of 70 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the ever-present nuclear threat, Thursday, August 6th, at the Japanese American Historical Plaza at Waterfront Park in Portland. 70 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki will feature speakers and performers, including Portland Taiko, and will provide opportunities for attendees to get involved in efforts to abolish nuclear weapons. That's 70 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The ever-present nuclear threat, Thursday, August 6th, 6 p.m. at the Japanese American Historical Plaza at Northwest NATO Parkway and Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's episode 9 of The River Signal.
receiver signal. This summer, three of us, Reed, Brian, and Galen, are traveling down the Mississippi River on the Channel Princess, a 30-foot paddlewheel riverboat. As we go, we're meeting musicians and recording them on boats and riverbanks, then weaving their music into a serialized radio story. The River Signal is fiction. It's set in a sort of weird alternate reality, and the world of each episode is inspired by the music we hear and the people we meet. We pull together every show in just 7 days, all while moving downriver and trying not to sink the boat.
This week, we motor south from Fulton, Illinois, heading for the Quad Cities. We're waiting for the river to get less pretty. Everyone keeps saying it's going to soon, but still we're surrounded by rolling hills, lush trees, and quaint towns with inviting docks. Coming out of Lock and Dam 15, we spot a big empty dock on the Illinois side, near downtown Rock Island. Our second day there, we meet up with David Zolo, a veteran of the Iowa music scene. In a shaded park overlooking the river, he sets up his keyboard on the grass, pulls off his boots, and launches into a high-energy set. David's music, as well as his lightning-quick wit, is the inspiration for this week's episode.
A lot of those tunes on my new record were written in institutional settings, a treatment facility, hospitals, strangely enough. So I went to a place in Nashville, 12-step rehab center, but it was, you know, it was a lockdown place, and they didn't let you have any music or any books, which, you know, because that would trigger something. Like, you know, I've been a drug addict for 25 years, man. There's nothing that's not a trigger. You know, they had a little piano in a broom closet there, and I went into this broom closet for an hour every day, and I wrote probably half of my new record in there, and it saved my life, and it did. I mean, it literally saved my life.
Episode 9, The Entertainer.
This is Envoy Benson, broadcasting to the River Signal from a crappy handheld radio. I'm not doing so great today. My flannels are shredded, my knuckles and knees too, and I'm all alone. I've got no idea where the others are. All I know is last night I was inside that windmill, and I was following Reed down the stairs, trying to find shelter from that awful howling storm, and that's it. That's where I go blank.
I came to this morning on a riverbank, and right away I noticed the difference in the land. No more bluffs, just dead wood on mud flats. I must have been carried pretty far. Now I've got a brain-melting headache and a nasty wound in my right knee. And I'm so hungry. All day I've been walking this path, looking for game or berries or mushrooms, but it's barren out here. Nothing but sticks and mud. But there's something up there, in the water. Something big. It's a ship. And it almost looks like that paddlewheeler we saw weeks ago, the Delta Queen. I figured it'd be miles ahead of us by now, but no, that's definitely the Queen. It's anchored to a long white dock, and where the dock meets shore, a paved roadway snakes into the woods. I climb through the shoreline brush, step into the water, and listen. That music's familiar. Rick used to play the same sort of stuff at the Loose Moose. Night after night, he'd be strapped to that piano in the corner, mashing the keys and crooning about bad whiskey and good dogs. Honky tonk was what the foreman called it, and said it was what the visitors wanted to hear. It's getting dark, but I can still make out the walkways around the riverboat, and they're pretty much empty. The only people I can see are up top, pacing back and forth with lamplights. Guards, probably. The Before I have time to think it through and make the smart choice, I lower myself into the water and start swimming toward one of those huge anchor chains. Seems risky, but I gotta find some food and clean out this festering pit in my knee. I throw myself up over the railing and land hard on the deck. I'm realizing I didn't really think this part through. I'm a filthy, shoeless youper, and if those guards find me out here, they'll probably beat me senseless. I power limp toward the stern, trying door after door, but they're all locked. Ah, crap, now the show's done and people are gonna be out here on the deck. The last door, it's open. I duck inside. It appears to be a sort of supply closet, like that one in Superior Land where I kept my saws and trank darts. This one's mostly shelves, full of tablecloths and rags and tins of boot polish. But on one wall, there's an old piano. I am glad this door opened. I can hear voices out in the deck now, and they're not 10 feet away. There's nowhere to hide, so I back into a corner, take hold of my knife, and wait. Since the badger has quite poor... In walks a guy wearing a blue top hat and tuxedo. I tighten my grip on the knife, but the guy doesn't notice me. He just takes off his coat and hangs it on a mop, then lights a cigarette and sits down at the piano bench. Try to get a better look at his hands, and I don't notice the cans of paint until I kick him over. Instantly, he's up, reaching into the piano bench. I don't know what he's got in there, and his eyes are a little googly, so I raise up my hands. I'm sorry, I say. I got thrown out of an exploding windmill, and I'm hungry, and green stuff's oozing from my knee, and I had nowhere else to go. He stares at me for a long while. Then he smiles and shuts the bench. I'm Zolo, he says, extending a hand. And that story of yours sounds way too weird to be made up. He hands me a jug from the shelf, and when I ask if it's for drinking or for sanitizing my knee, he says, yep. Ooh, that burns. As I'm breathing through it, Zolo asks what the hell I meant by an exploding windmill. I give him the not quite short version. Tell him about meeting Reed and Huckins, about finding the Channel Princess, and about how our trip down to the Delta was really going pretty well until that howl storm fell upon Fulton, sank our riverboat, and maybe my friends, too. He stays silent for a moment, just smokes that cigarette and massages his knuckles, and then he looks up and says, once I was Delta-bound, too. Zolo says he grew up in the plains, always moving, hiding from the wind in crumbling hotels and saloons, anywhere with a piano, really. One night he was playing at a Northern Exchange and the proprietor, a jolly guy with big forearms, asked if he'd ever considered crewing the Delta Queen. It sounded like the perfect gig, working the crowd at a proper riverboat honky-tonk, then hopping off at the end of the line, in the Delta, far from the haze and gusting winds. Zolo turns to the piano and starts playing again. Over his shoulder, he says, but it was just a scam. I've been on the Queen for years, and though I bet I've been through the Delta dozens of times, I've never even seen it. They make me play pretty much nonstop, and when I'm not playing, I'm in my bunk on lockdown. But once a day, between sets, I get an hour or so to myself in here. That's when I play what I want to play. I dump some more of that lightning water on my knee, and then ask why he doesn't just get off the boat. Zolo says, "Kid, there's more crazy out in that river than you and I know what to do with. And maybe the queen's a dive, but where else can you find an audience that still knows when to clap? And besides, I've seen other crew try to escape, and they didn't." Now Zolo reaches for that jug and takes a swig. "As far as I know," he says, "no one's escaped. I mean, I've thought about it, but I've seen what those guards can do with their flintlocks, and anyway, I'm no swimmer. I'm a Dust Bowl baby through and through." Zolo stands up, grabs his coat and hat. "That's me," he says. "Gotta be back on stage in 5 minutes." He opens the door and halfway out, he turns back and says, "Buddy, I don't know how you got on this paddle trap or how you plan to get back off it, but I'm no stranger to hard travel. You're welcome to hide out here as long as you need to." As soon as he leaves, I spread some linens on the floor, lie on my back, and shut out the light. I found a good spot here. I hope the others are somewhere safe too. As I'm drifting off, I can hear Zolo up above me, stomping his feet and hammering those keys.
Gone. Huckins, the envoy? Bob, Charlie, and Kendra? And where the princess used to be? They're only snapped mooring lines around broken trunks. My head is spinning, and there's a nasty gash on my forearm, and my whole body is covered in scrapes, and I'm desperate for a drink. So I hobble down to the river's edge and slurp handfuls of muddy water. Tastes worse than it smells, but I'm too thirsty to care. I wash away the blood and cover my wounds with broadleaf, lean back against a trunk, and stare across the river. I'm far from home and alone. I'm all banged up, and a monster storm ate my friends. I'd gotten pretty fond of those guys. I felt that together, we'd make it all the way to the Delta and slay that dastardly carp. It's hard to imagine continuing on by myself. Out of the corner of my eye, I see something moving with the river. It's a log, big and round, bobbing right along. The current is passing fast, so I have to act quick. I grab a broad piece of driftwood and push off into the river, holding the plank ahead of me as I kick through the water. The cool, muddy water is refreshing, soothing my battered body. I push sideways through the current, reaching the log as it spins downstream. I haul myself atop it and steer it with the driftwood, heading to the swift current of the main channel. As I float downstream, I feel a spark of hope, like I could ride the whole river on the back of this hardy log. I don't need some fancy boat. Why, if a lonesome pinecone can float the length of the Mississippi, so can log and I. Timbers are scattered across the water's surface. Some look like the rough-hewn rafters from the old windmill. I scan ahead, hoping to spy one of my friends holding tight to a beam. It's then I notice a splotch of red amongst the driftwood. I paddle over, and sure enough, it's a rubber fender from the Channel Princess. Further downstream, I see the sun flashing off metal. It's one of the fuel tanks. I push onwards, following the trail of the wreckage. When I see those polished aluminum sides and that unmistakable red trim, I feel like someone is looking out for me. The Princess, still afloat. I paddle hard, sure the others are on board. As I get closer, my heart sinks. The boat lists hard to port, spinning aimlessly in the current. I push log alongside the tilted gunwale and hop aboard. The hull is nearly flooded, and it's a miracle it wasn't sunk by the storm. I grab a cook pot and begin bucketing out the water. Bucket after bucket, I slowly reclaim the boat from the river. By the time I've righted it and gotten the engine above water, the sun is burning low on the horizon. The electrics are shot, and I wonder if it'll start. It's alive. Now I'm at the wheel, pushing the throttle full bore. I point the bow downriver, still hopeful that I'll find my companions. Twilight creeps across the river, and the banks grow shapeless in the shadows. The crickets are singing a strange tune tonight. Wait, those aren't crickets. No, someone is playing music. And now I can see it up ahead. 100 glowing lanterns seem to hover in space. By golly, it's the Delta Queen, that huge riverboat that nearly swamped us in the Driftless. Its paddle wheels are motionless, and it's held tight on a massive anchor chain. Silhouetted figures walk the decks. I'm hesitant to get any closer lest I be seen, so I pull the Princess off into the shadows along the bank, kill the engine, and drop anchor. Now I can clearly hear the organ, and it's entrancing, like nothing I've ever heard before. I lay low on the bow, and my exhaustion starts to take hold. My eyes are drooping, and the music is lulling me into unconsciousness. When I see him, a dark figure, scaling the Queen's anchor chain. Apparently, whoever's on the top deck sees him too. They're motioning below and shining their lamps. In the pale light, I see a mop of mud-caked blonde hair. Hawkins? If he's alive, he's already getting himself back into trouble. I shake myself awake. This could get mighty interesting, and I'd best be ready to make a move.
Help thy brother's boat. Lord, I know we reach the shore. You gotta help thy brothers.
Expected guards, but the decks are empty. Everyone must be inside listening to that music. Good thing, too, I'm way too weak to fight or even run. All day I've been floating on a busted mill sail, paddling around backwaters, looking for anything that survived the storm. But I've only seen signs of destruction, scattered planks along the shore and uprooted trees. Every door is locked. I try to peer through a portal, but all I see is my own face, and I look terrible. There's blood caked on my forehead and in my hair. I can't believe I made it out of that windmill alive. And though I'd like to believe otherwise, I kind of doubt the others did. I drop to my knees and crawl towards the stern, staying beneath the portals. There's polished brass bits along the walkway, reflecting light from the wall lanterns. They're spotless, except for the one I'm standing on. There's a chip of something, and when I bend down to look, I can see it's dried blood. So that's kind of ominous. There's another drip ahead, and I crawl along, following the trail down the walkway. Caught on one of the railings, I find a scrap of cloth. It's a flannel. I'm not an expert on plaid patterning of Superior Land, but that looks like the envoy's uniform. So he made it out of that windmill too. But he must have been captured. I shuffle along the deck until I find a door with a spot of blood on the handle. I grope around for a weapon. The wooden railing isn't as strong as it looks, and I break off a section. Feels good to bust up all this pretty gingerbread. I'm not sure if I should just open the door or kick it in. But I'm feeling expansive tonight. It is the envoy. He looks even worse than me. His clothes are tattered and the back of his neck is basically one huge bruise. After we've both gotten over the shock and bumbled through one of those backslappy awkward man hugs, we swap stories. The envoy hasn't seen any sign of the princess or Reed. He tells me about meeting Zolo, some kind of honky-tonk man who's stuck on the boat. The way he tells it, it doesn't sound like it's an easy ride down to the Delta. Ah, here's the man himself, bursting through the door in a snappy blue tuxedo. I stick out a hand to introduce myself, but he ignores it. He's frantic. His shift just ended, he says, and he saw the guards coming down from the top deck with flash beams and flintlocks. We've got to get out of here, Zolo says. Now. That's them, he says. They're coming. We run out to the railing. I can hear the boots making their way down from the upper deck. It's dark, but I can see that the river is fast here, and I know the envoy won't be able to swim with that bum knee. We all hear it at the same time. Looking out into the darkness, I can just make out the flash of the paddle wheels on the Channel Princess. It looks so miniature coming alongside the Delta Queen, but at the moment, it's the sweetest thing I've seen in my life. Zolo is ushering us towards the stern. I can see Reed at the wheel, looking up at us as he motors across the current. They're getting closer. Any moment now, they'll see us. As we're climbing up onto the railing, the envoy turns to Zolo and says, "You're coming too, right?" Now Zolo starts talking rapid fire, saying he can't, he's not ready, he doesn't even know if he can swim anymore. And anyway, the queen will probably take him to the Delta someday, if he just keeps his head down and keeps performing. I can see them now, coming down the stairs. Down in the water, Reed's bringing the princess in close, trying to hold the boat still in the current. The envoy and I are leaning out over the churning water. Behind us, Zolo's still on the bench, head down, hands on his knees. This is crazy. We can't wait any longer. I spin around and look down, and it's a big drop. But I close my eyes, I hope the others are behind me, and I jump. I've been motoring all night, taking back channels too shallow for the Delta Queen. The envoy and Reed have been asleep for hours now. But Zolo's still on the bow, sitting on the bulkheads and watching the moonlit water. At dawn, he points up shore. Up on the bank, there's a beat-up canoe, full to the brim with brown water. "This is my stop," he says. When I tell him he ought to stay aboard and come with us to the Delta, he smiles and says, "Well, then maybe I'll see you there." Zolo pushes the Channel Princess from shore. He gives me a wave and then turns and starts bailing the boat. That canoe is a wreck. I have a hard time believing he'll make it down to the Delta on that thing. But considering the splintered and dripping walls of the Channel Princess, I probably shouldn't judge. I watch him until the channel bends and he disappears behind the trees. I've got some bailing of my own to do.
Missing the last departing boat to get some time with the Judas Gold. Light his whole song, Lord, from Lord, my lips still burn from singing. I heard that song so many times, twice betraying a chance to find darkness of a different kind. You know, it left my blood ringing.
This episode of The River Signal was written and recorded by Galen Huckins, Brian Benson, and Reed Lustig, audio editing by Jill Schupak. Special thanks to Nick Bakkenfeld, Charlie Kreider, Brian Dietz, Ellis Kell, Sean Moeller, Tom Unley, David Zolo, Ear Trumpet Labs, and KBOO 90.7. For pictures and video of the riverboat trip, and a video of David Zolo performing in Rock Island, Illinois, check out riversignal.com. Thanks for listening. Stick around for our session with David Zolo and tune in next week for episode 10.
Today, I return on my bike from the marina with a bag full of patched fuel line to find David Zolo unpacking his gear in the parking lot. A prolific pianist and songwriter, Dave is incredibly busy in the Iowa music scene. He's joined by his dad and two friends, an elderly trio of poets who reminisce about beatniks of old. Soon, Dave sets up his red keyboard and PA in the park overlooking the river, and as he plays, he hammers his barefoot in the grass, keeping time to the music. Tremble all life.
a smile, I'll open up my eyes so that I might see. I was humbled by my vices and shattered by my silence. I sit alone and try to find my voice. Oh, and I sometimes think that about you. All the sinking walls that find you. It's been a long time, honey, since we've talked. I feel like I don't know you. I must confess. Oh, but I've been feeling better, and I still admire the big and tough head light you throw while you undress. Oh, while you undress. Top an altar. These revelations never came on to glory. Oh, but it's been my insistence that I have offered up resistance to my love like it's somebody else's story. No, but I've given up on all that. I wrote it off to anxiousness and grief, I guess. I ain't too proud or begrudging to compose these lines for you. While you undress. Oh, while you undress. Oh, while you undress. While you undress. While you undress.
So I have a tattoo on my arm, two tattoos of my grandfather, who was a jazz pianist and led the house orchestra at the Stork Club in New York from 1935 to 53. My grandfather, 1933, had a trio on Cape Cod, which was kind of a spiritual home for him, kind of before it had become a real popular, you know, tourist destination. It was more kind of fishing villages. So my grandfather was a lifelong musician. He had a stroke at the piano, went back to his car, and then had a massive stroke and spent the last 10 years of his life paralyzed and bedridden. And then my folks came to Iowa after meeting in Boston so my dad could attend the writer's workshop. So he's a writer. My mom's the daughter of a working, independent, you know, jazz musician. It's funny because I did in college an honors thesis on his life, kind of a biography of his life and a history of white jazz, which his life kind of mirrored the movement of, and my life has just imitated his in so many ways. My mother sat me and my brother both down at the piano when I was about 3 and he was 5, and I literally could immediately, you know, make sounds on the piano. I was given lessons. I was always a reluctant student in some ways. But I have no doubt, you know, as a presence in my life, it was always there, and it was always something that was in me. I mean, I had no intention of being a musician at all.
Tell me, people, what you do? If someone in need reached out for you, would you take their hand and help them through?
A lot of those tunes on my new record were written in institutional settings, a treatment facility, hospitals, strangely enough. So I went to a place in Nashville, 12-step rehab center, but it was, you know, it was a lockdown place, and they didn't let you have any music or any books, which, you know, because there were triggers. I'm like, you know, I've been a drug addict for 25 years, man. There's nothing that's not a trigger. In fact, if you take away books and music, I want to get high really bad. Like, but the people that sent me, that paid for my my treatment, was a thing called Musician's Care, paid for by the recording industry. The one thing they stipulate is anybody they pay to go there has to be given an hour a day on whatever the instrument that they play. You know, they had a little piano and a broom closet there, and I went into this broom closet for an hour every day, and I wrote probably half of my new record in there. Rehab, man, it saved my life, and it did. I mean, it literally saved my life. My disease was close to you know, taking my life. So a lot of the songs on my new record are songs about when the human spirit is close to being broken, which, you know, mine was. I was on the verge of giving up, and of losing my, you know, my love of life and my love of people. I was in a bad place. I lost a few friends in that time too. My friend who used to call me Ham-Fisted was a great piano player, and I was sitting, died of cancer at 29 while I was making the record, writing the songs. Bunch of different friends that died, some from drugs, some just from, you know, early deaths. And so, yeah, I mean, I was in a lot of pain. Those songs are real, really raw kind of cries of pain.
Caroline was my best friend from the neighborhood. She taught me a thing or two about what makes love good. And we kept each other company till I finally left that town. Together, oh, when I came back, he cried out. She only wanted what she could hold in her hands. Caroline never made untoward demands. She was looking for something. Small town, I guess. And he was not a good man, and he could not find the time to tell her that he loved her, and she was always on his mind. And she only wanted what she could hold.
My favorite art is rooted in a sense of place. There's something about this part of the country that seems to be out of time and, you know, in its own way. being in Iowa where there is no industry to shape. It's here you get to do what you do, free from a certain conversation, a certain dialogue that can sometimes be present in any art that's being made for commercial consumption today. I mean, there's people like Will Whitmore who've done it, who've managed to really, you know, have a nice career on a different kind of commercial level. There's no doubt that the music that I play is using forms and styles that are, you know, rooted in an earlier generation. I'm not an avant-gardist in any stretch, you know, any sense of the word. You know, I mean, I'm a minimalist, but I'm a traditionalist too. I am a fiend for Floyd Kramer, the great country, you know, stylist who he invented that, what they call the slip note style. And I also am very influenced by Otis Spann, that kind of post-war Chicago blues piano playing. One came out of that honky-tonk thing and one came out of a blues play, a time where solo piano was a common thing to be the entertainment, whether it was in a bordello or a house living room, you know, for a rent party, whatever. You know, there's a lot of pianos around and you'd find some guy that made his living, you know, doing that. I don't know, I grew up playing an old broken down piano. I have no idea. I've been told by more than one, you know, sophisticated pianist what a brutal touch that I have, like, or what a brutal lack of touch that I have. I had a good friend who used to use the words ham-fisted to describe my style frequently. And he was such a wonderful musician, and I was always so wounded. No, it's not true, but of course it was totally true. And that's, I think, a really good kind of breakdown of what I do, you know, and where I learned to do what I did, which was in, you know, bars, playing a lot of three-set. My first band, and the guys that I was playing with, Bo Ramsey and Greg, you know, you would come in and Greg Brown, and they would do a three-set night, you know, which a little much for my taste, but it was just kind of the way you did it. That's where I learned to do what I do, and I probably, yeah, the single biggest shaping influence on what I do, because I do a lot more gigs than I do make records.
came down that mountain was a terrible fall. I landed on my back, no breath to call, and even if there would have been anyone at all, I would not let them. You know my bones are mending, but my heart they could not fix. Might work for drinks and maybe a meal. So sometimes I bring the boys along for the ride. They do not like it, but it's cash on the side. The only problem is no place to hide when it's go time. All of the pimps push the junkies, come around when they hear that my band's in town. We never ever put them. Way. I will go through the motions, collect my pay. Might stick around if you got something to say. This ain't really a job, it's more like stealing.
The great dystopian novels are the ones that I've read. You know, it's always about how difficult humanity can be towards each other and towards the world around them. And those books, I mean, I'm a huge Orwell fan, and I'm a huge fan of Brave New World. I wouldn't say I'm a Huxley fan as much as I am a Brave New World fan. Or Animal Farm. I mean, quit teaching it in the junior high schools. Teach it in, like, you know, graduate political science seminars. I mean, those books thrilled me. But I do like to think, at the end of the day, that people are kinder and gentler when left to the devices of being human. It's, you know, I want my life to be, as my dad said about you guys, a clear reflection of my values. I mean, I like to think, as the eternally optimistic person I am and a person who really fights against, you know, the misanthropic worldview, and at every turn I try to remember how much I love people and why people, you know, thrill me as much as they do, and why the great thing, you know, about music and art and life is that we share these things, you know, these beautiful things. If that's the world, I guess it wouldn't be very dystopian then, would it? It'd be more of a utopian, post-apocalyptic, and then when I've been an apocalypse, it probably would have been like, yeah, the real second coming. Great, you sent a love song, what does that prove? Tired, are you talking? Well, I need a change, I gotta move. And all them things you promised me, but you never could deliver. I thought you were my hero, but you're just another Indian girl. I wanna believe those words you whispered in my ear when you had that fever. But I will not end up all alone, solitary griever. And I whisper something back to you. Hope you don't find it shocking. You're the one that likes to talk. I'm the one that
as good as walking out of the cradle. Endlessly rocking. Fit all the different sections. Maybe I could say the song. Maybe likewise stop your heart defection. I promise I won't talk too much. I'm glad I hold your hand. And you can feel the heartbeat trapped inside the vessel. That long lost man will gather up the pieces. Like spring geese in the field are flocking. Take one more journey like we used to, out of the cradle.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 17th annual Pickathon, July 31st through August 2nd. Pickathon is 3 days and 7 stages of performances by a variety of bands such as Tune Yards, Shabazz Palace.